Okay, try to picture this. A really bustling, thriving scene. You've got the sounds of thousands of sheep, goats, cattle, lots of voices murmuring. It paints this picture of incredible prosperity,
Yeah,
right?
absolutely. Two families just flourishing together on the same land.
But under that success, you can almost feel this tension building. Their growth, the very thing that should be a blessing, it's actually becoming their biggest problem.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's a classic family drama setup, but the stakes here are ancient, and they echo way beyond just them.
Exactly. And that sets the stage perfectly for our deep dive today.
We're stepping into a really pivotal moment from Genesis chapter 13, looking at verses 5 through 10.
And this isn't just some old story about a family spat.
Not at all. It's
No.
this profound narrative that shows how, wealth, pressure on resources, actual land pressure, and the fundamental choices people make.
Yeah.
How all that can lead to a major separation, often with huge consequences down the line.
So our mission today really is to go beyond just telling the story. We want to unpack these verses with you.
Right. Looking at the original Hebrew, because there are insights there, sometimes surprising ones, hidden in the specific words and phrases.
Yeah, we want to explore what those words tell us about why these characters did what they did, and maybe find some timeless lessons about, I don't know, decisions, humility, trust.
The goal is for you to come away with a richer feel for this ancient text. Maybe even a new way to think about your own choices,
A new lens, perhaps.
Exactly. It's a chance to see past the surface, the simple translation, and appreciate how the original language doesn't just say what happened, but gives clues about why. It tells us something about human nature, maybe even destiny.
Okay, so let's dive in. Genesis 13. The conflict is starting, and weirdly, it's because things are going too well.
Paradoxical, isn't it? Verse 5 starts it off. And Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents.
Now, also sounds simple enough in English, but you mentioned the Hebrew gam lodge also lot. You said that phrase does a bit more heavy lifting.
I think it does, yeah.
Yeah.
It's subtle. But Gamlashan isn't just sticking Anne there. It's almost like the text puts a little spotlight on Lot.
Highlighting him.
Kind of.
Yeah.
It elevates him from just being Abram's tag-along nephew to, well, a significant player in his own right. It signals that Lot's wealth is now substantial, independent.
Ah, okay. So it's setting him up almost as an equal, economically speaking.
Pretty much. Remember, we heard earlier, Abram was Kavod, heavy with possessions. Now Lot's adding his own significant weight, literally and metaphorically.
And that becomes the problem, the success itself. Verse 6 says, the land could not sustain them dwelling together.
Right.
I pictured, overgrazed fields, not enough water. But the Hebrew is more evocative, isn't it? Lishnam hari lishet yadao.
That's it. The land could not carry them to dwell together. That word, natty, to lift, to carry, it's powerful.
It makes it sound like the land itself is struggling under the load.
Exactly. It's not just about logistics, like not enough acres.
Yeah.
It gives this sense of burden, of distress, almost like the earth itself is groaning. This is too much.
Wow. That really changes the feel from just a resource issue to something deeper.
It hints at this ecological or maybe social strain pushing the limits.
And it makes you think, doesn't it? Have you ever been in a situation where success, maybe in business or even just family growth, suddenly created new problems, feeling crowded out by the good
It
stuff?
happens, and that pressure, well, it inevitably leads to conflict. Verse 7 is direct. There was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock.
Strife. The Hebrew is what he wrote. What kind of strife are we talking about here? Just bickering.
Probably more than that. Read often implies a pretty serious dispute. Think contention, quarreling, sometimes even the kind of thing that might end up in a legal setting. So it's a significant breakdown, not just a minor tiff.
Okay, so things are getting serious between the staff, reflecting the tension at the top.
Right. And then there's that crucial bit of context dropped in right after.
Ah, yes. The Canaanite and the Perizzite were then dwelling in the land. That's huge, right? This isn't happening in private.
Absolutely critical detail. They're not in some empty wilderness. There are established local peoples watching this family drama unfold.
So their internal spat has an audience. What does that do to the situation?
It ramps up the pressure immensely. Think about it. Reputation, honor, keeping the peace with your neighbors. That was vital for groups like Abram's.
Especially if you're the newcomers.
Exactly. So this internal conflict isn't just messy for them. It threatens their standing, their credibility, maybe even their safety among these other nations. It's bad PR, basically.
It really makes you consider how external factors, even just knowing someone else is watching, can escalate things within a group, doesn't it?
It absolutely can. It forces your hand sometimes.
And it's right in this pressure cooker, internal strife, externalized, that Abram does something, well, pretty remarkable.
Yes, moving to verse 8. Abram takes the lead. He goes to Lot and says, essentially, look, let's not have this strife between us, please. We're family.
He says, Najim, men, brothers, there's a real warmth there, an appeal to that bond.
There is. And what's striking is who is saying it.
Right. Abram's the elder. He's the patriarch, the one God spoke to, the one promised the land. He could have easily just said, okay, Lot, here's how it's going to be. Pulled rank.
He absolutely could have. And culturally, that might have even been expected. The senior figure lays down the law.
But he doesn't. He appeals to kinship. He sort of humbles himself. Is that too strong a word?
No, I think humility is exactly the right word. For someone in his position to yield like that, to prioritize harmony over his clear authority, that's extraordinary leadership. He's choosing relationship over being right, kinship over contention. It's quite countercultural, really.
It really makes you stop and think, what does it take to de-escalate, especially when you do have the power, to choose that path of, I guess, connection over control?
It takes a lot. And Abram doesn't stop there. His offer in verse 9 is just wow.
Yeah, he says, look, isn't the whole land in front of you? Let's separate. You choose. If you go left, I'll go right. If you go right, I'll go left.
And that symmetry in the Hebrew is beautiful. It's like this balanced offering of choice.
And he, the guy promised all the land by God, gives the first pick to his nephew. That's staggering generosity.
It is. But I think it's more than just generosity. It's what you called a super faith moment.
Explain that. What makes it about faith?
Well, think about it. Abram is essentially saying, my trust in God's promise is so absolute, it doesn't depend on me grabbing the best-looking piece of land right now. You choose, Lot. God's plan for me is bigger than this choice.
I see. He's letting go of control, trusting the divine assurance will hold true regardless of Lot's decision.
Precisely. Especially when you remember, as you pointed out, he hasn't always been rock solid in his faith. Think about Egypt with Sarai, or later with Hagar.
Right, he's had his wobbles.
He has. So this moment shows real growth. He's acting out of deep reliance on God's word, even when it means giving up an obvious immediate advantage.
That context makes his offer even more powerful. It's not just politeness. It's a profound act of trust built on past lessons, maybe.
I think so.
It really pushes you to ask, how often do we truly trust a bigger picture enough to let go of immediate control or advantage? It's easy to say you trust, but acting on it like this, that's different.
It really is. And that sets up the contrast perfectly for Lot's choice in verse 10. What does Lot do?
The text says, Lot lifts up his eyes. We should love the Inoue. You mentioned this phrase, lifts up his eyes. It's kind of a narrative cue in Hebrew.
Yes, it often signals that someone is about to make a decision based on sight, on what they can see, on the visual appeal of the options. Evaluation based on appearance.
And what does he see?
He sees the Jordan Valley. And it's described as well-watered everywhere, lush. It looked like paradise.
Like the Garden of Eden, it says, or like the fertile land of Egypt they'd known.
Exactly. From his perspective, standing there and looking, it's the jackpot. It looks immediately prosperous, easy, the obvious best choice based on visual evidence.
Makes sense from a purely practical standpoint.
Absolutely. But it highlights that his decision is driven by the tangible, the visible, the immediate reward.
Which, let's be honest, is a very human way to decide things, isn't it? We often go for what looks best right now.
We do. And that's where the core contrast crystallizes.
Abram and Lot, faith versus sight. Is it that simple?
Well, it's shorthand, but it captures the essence. Abram is trusting God's debor, the spoken word, the promise. It's faith in something unseen.
Yeah.
Lot, on the other hand, trusts his aneim, his eyes. He relies on the immediate visual data, what seems best for his self-interest right now.
So debor versus aneim, word versus sight. What does that tell us about their fundamental outlooks?
Relying on debor, on the word, implies you're orienting your life around a promise, something maybe not yet visible, requiring trust and active listening. It's commitment to a future guided by something beyond the sensory.
Okay, a covenantal view, maybe.
Perhaps. Whereas relying on aneim, the eyes, suggests your world is grounded primarily in what you can perceive, measure, grasp right now. It's more pragmatic, maybe more focused on immediate, tangible benefit.
One looking towards a promised horizon, the other focused on the immediate landscape.
That's a good way to put it. And this difference, this choice of what to trust the unseen word or the seen world, really sets the trajectory for their lives. It's the pivot point for their very different stories that unfold from here.
It really makes you reflect on your own life, doesn't it? When you're at a crossroads, what's guiding you? Is it mostly what looks best right now, the lush valley?
Or is it a deeper principle, a promise you hold on to, a long-term vision that requires trusting something beyond what your eyes can immediately confirm?
So wrapping this up, we've really dug into just a few verses here. Genesis 13:5, Dihen.
Mm-hmm. A moment packed with tension.
Yeah, we saw how even good things, like prosperity, can surprisingly spark conflict.
And we saw Abram, the one with the promise, showing this incredible humility and faith, trusting in something bigger, something unseen.
While Lot, well, he made a choice based on what looked good, the immediate visible advantage, man of sight.
And this ancient story, this deep dive, it shows us that this tension between the quick reward and the long-term vision, between looking out for number one and trusting something beyond yourself, it's not old news. It's still incredibly relevant.
Totally. These kinds of choices, big or small, they really do shape our paths, don't they?
They fundamentally do. They determine whether we're navigating by sight alone or by a deeper compass.
So maybe the question to leave you with is this. As you navigate your own life, what are the Jordan Valleys calling to you right now? You know, the options that look so lush, so appealing, so obviously right on the surface.
And in those moments of decision, what are the principles, the promises, the deeper convictions, the debris in your life that you're choosing to trust, even when the path ahead isn't perfectly clear to your own eyes?
Something to definitely ponder.